And that was another fiscal.
Good afternoon. The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. It's April 15th. We're going to try and make our way through a busy agenda with a number of things on it. We'll start with opening work session on House Bill 2657. Troy, we have some amendments, I think.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2657 establishes requirement to be met by applicant before local government can consider application to rezone non-industrial land use as it is planned and zoned for industrial use and include advertise availability of land to potential industrial developers, provide change of circumstances of reduced value or utility of the land, solicit offers to purchase of land from potential buyers with ability to hold or improve the land in anticipation of industrial development. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we are in possession of the required paperwork, legislative fiscal, legislative revenue, and the dash two amendments.
I just realized that we have Representative Nathanson not here yet. I know this one matters to her, so we may want to actually, I should have looked, but I'm going to temporarily, please remember that, I'm going to temporarily close the work session on House Bill 2657. We'll come back to that in a little bit. House Bill 2277 is going to be, here she is, right on cue, going to be carried over to Wednesday. With Representative Nathanson's arrival, we reopen the work session on House Bill 2657. Representative Nathanson, we just heard a description of amendments on House Bill 2657. Is there any discussion of the amendments? Representative Gorsuch?
Do I make a motion?
Sure.
Make a motion.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
I'd like to make a motion to move the dash two amendments for House Bill 2657.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2657. Is there any discussion? Any objections to the motion? I don't see any. The dash two amendments are adopted. Troy, do we have a rescission letter on the land use subsequent?
Do you not see one, Mr. Chairman? No, we do not.
Okay. I think that's as far as we can go on the bill then. So we obviously will, if the bill is to move forward, we'll need to do something else given the deadline that's fast approaching. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2657 and carry it over to Wednesday. Okay. Let's go to a public hearing on House Bill 3464 next. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3464 modifies schedule and conditions of issuance of lottery bonds to pay cost of Coos Bay Channel Project, declares emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you. And we're looking for the.
We are in possession of all of the required paperwork.
Okay. Representative McEwen, do you want to kick us off? Feel free to bring anyone you'd like with you, your senator, Mr. Callery. I don't see anyone else who's signed up.
Thank you. Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gorsuch, and Benz, members of the committee. My name is Katty McEwen. I'm the state representative for House District Number 9 down on the South Coast and a former port commissioner for the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay. The Port of Coos Bay is the largest deep draft coastal port between San Francisco and Puget Sound and is a critical economic driver, not only for the South Coast, but for the state and for the region if everything goes as planned. In 2006, as you all know, the world economy was strong and all indications were that maritime trade was poised to increase dramatically. The Port Commission, appointed by Governor Kulongoski and assigned the task of taking advantage of the assets of a deep water channel and using the port as an economic driver, determined that increases in the depth and the width of the shipping channel were necessary to accommodate the expected increase in number and size of vessels entering Coos Bay. At the request of then Senator Berger and Representative Roblin, the 2007 Legislative Assembly approved $60 million in lottery bonding capacity to perform this work in three increments and keep Southwest Oregon's economic potential running strong. This authority was set to expire at the start of the current biennium. Unfortunately, just after this funding was approved and work was being done with our the Corps of Engineers and our federal delegation to work towards a channel modification, the global economy took a turn for the worse and the number and size of ships expected in Coos Bay shrank dramatically. While the port continued to move forward on the feasibility study and the environmental impact statement using the first increment of financing, which was $5 million, under the oversight of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the actual dredging work was postponed and most of the bonding authority has not been used. The port is continuing the Coos Bay Channel project and is anticipating completion of the first phase of this project by early 2015. This bill revises the dates for the distribution of the remaining $55 million to match up with the schedule for the final two phases of this very important project and the anticipated increases in international commerce that would strengthen the Oregon economy. With me today, I have Mr. Martin Callery, Chief Commercial Officer for the Port of Coos Bay, who can answer any technical questions you may have regarding the bill. And we also are fortunate to have with us today Senator Roblin, who was the sponsor of the initial bill and also is very familiar with the project and what we're trying to do on the South Coast to revive not only an economy for that area, but for the state and the region as a whole. So I will turn this over to Mr. Callery.
Thank you. Mr. Callery.
Chair Reed, Vice Chairs Benson and Gorsuch, members of the committee, I'm Martin Callery, Chief Commercial Officer for the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay. I have submitted written testimony, which you should have in front of you. It gives you background and a current situation analysis. The only thing I would like to add to that is one of the major challenges in the marine transportation industry in taking advantage of opportunities to diversify the cargo base or attract new industry into an area is the timeline required for permitting and construction for major navigation projects. That's why this project was originally designed the way it was, so that we had the increments for the feasibility study, the environmental impact statement, and then later for the engineering design, and then the final increment was a non-federal cost share for the federal participation in the project. We still see significant opportunities in the Coos Bay Harbor. We are still entertaining proposals from various interested parties, and I would really urge that this bill go forward. It is necessary for the strength of our economy in Southwest Oregon. Thank you.
Mr. Callery, Senator. Feels strange to say that, by the way, still.
I know. Thank you. Arnie Roblin, State Senator, District 5. I'm here because this is a continuation of something that began a number of years ago with Senator Verger, and an understanding that the port is a major asset for our state and our region, and in particular our local community. And that, you know, the feasibility study, the $5 million we spent, was money well spent. We did find out, you know, where we could go and what we could do and how we could do it in a way that did not impact the other local economies, did not impact the Bay and the South Slough and all of those things. We got that information. We know where we have to go and how wide we can make it and where the turns are and all of the things that would make this the world-class port it can be to handle those super ships that are now being built to go on the ocean. So the Coast Guard has looked at that along with other kinds of things over the times to say, yep, the turns can be made. We can get there. We have in place our pilots to get boats in and out safely. It is the closest and the shortest route on the West Coast, really, for getting from the ocean to the dock, a mere few miles in comparison to some of the other places you'd have to go. So we stand ready to do that, but you don't want to do it and spend the money until you need to spend the money. And so that was how we developed the first one, take the money we needed to get the beginnings done, then take the next amount of money when the project was there, and then do the final part, including using money from the federal government to match that, along with the companies themselves. So we feel very comfortable that having us have the opportunity to extend this as the markets come back, as the ships start looking for other ports where they can offload. The port is in the place right now where it's actually going to have a slip and work on making sure that they have some of those things available that can handle the smaller ships now, but available to handle the bigger ships when they come. So we really appreciate you hearing this. We look forward to answering any questions that you might have. And we see this as an economic driver for the whole state, not just our area.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Gorsuch.
One quick question. So it's very short. I'm just curious, how deep is this proposed channel?
The Coosa Bay Harbor is authorized, it's a federal authorization at 37 feet, mm-hmm. and from shipping lane to berth is about 7 miles, which is very different than dredging the Columbia, which was, what, 80 miles.
Correct.
Yeah, this is a very short a short channel modification. A lot of the channel already scours at 49 feet, which is where we need to go, but there are some places where there's sandstone that needs to be dealt with. These projects take a very, very long time, anywhere from 7 to 15 years and beyond, because it's a very slow process at the federal level to get through all of the permitting, the feasibility, the EIS, and all the things that have to be done. And we're quite a ways down the road with the studies that we need to do, but we want to keep this project moving forward. And so we'll be down to 49 feet with the authorization for this project.
And at 49 feet is pretty much everything. The other big issue about that is that there are very few other ports that can get to 49. In Oregon, we will be the only one that's going to get to 49 feet. So if we are going to be a part of the Asian trade and the Pacific trade in general, with the future ships that they're making, this is the only port that can handle the largest of those ships.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Doherty.
And real quickly, the Coast Guard's all on board, and they're encouraging the project go forward and so on. Okay, thank you.
Representative Lively.
So the question I have, so how long does this last? If we spend this type of money to do this, then how long before we'll have to do it again?
Chair Reed, Representative Lively, normally you'll see incremental changes in the maritime transportation industry in about 10-year cycles. What they're projecting right now in the newest class of vessels that's out there are in the 47 to 49-foot range. We don't anticipate that what they're calling the super ship now, which is about an 18,000 TEU vessel, we don't anticipate that it would be really online for much of the West Coast. It's going to be used primarily, at least on the marine transportation analysts, they're thinking it's going to be in Asia, Northern Europe routing. So we think if the Coosa Bay Channel was at minus 49, minus 51, something in that range, there would be easily a 40-year lifespan of it.
And from the standpoint of once the dredging's done, you do maintenance dredging from time to time, but once you got the sandstone out of there, you're good for.
Thank you.
Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much. And that completes the list of people who have signed up to testify. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on House Bill 3464?
Thank you.
I don't see any. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3464 and open a work session on House Bill 3464. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3464 to the floor with the due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 3464 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? See any objections? See any? The motion carries. House Bill 3464 goes to the Committee on Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 3464 and open the work session on House Bill 3438. Troy, could you remind us?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 3438 permits any city to operate photo radar in school zone while school is in session, requires that police officer review video recording of conduct before issuing citation. We discussed last Friday. There are no amendments. Testimony has all been uploaded to OLIS. We are in possession of the required paperwork to move the bill.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3438 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 3438 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, this is a challenging bill. I studied it carefully. I talked to a number of people in my district. Because, of course, the cities can't afford one of these machines for the most part. They have to hire the machine to be brought in, and further, because the cities don't use this machine for fundraising, instead they use it to protect children, it seemed to be the right thing to expand the opportunity for all cities, not just those that now enjoy this opportunity to protect their kids. So that's why I'm a yes vote, or will be.
Thank you, Representative Benz. Further discussion, Representative Gorsuch.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond. Rep. Cameron last time asked a little bit about fatalities and injuries. I found an ODOT 2004 piece of information online talking about crosswalks in general. and it says 75% of driver errors in motor vehicle pedestrian crashes are a failure of the driver to yield to the pedestrian, and half of the pedestrians who are struck by vehicles are hit while they're in crosswalks. So I just wanted to add that in for the record.
Thank you, Representative Gorsuch. Other discussion? Any objections to the motion? I don't see any. The motion carries. House Bill 3438 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Since it's your bill, Representative Gorsuch, will you carry?
Love to.
Thank you, Representative Gorsuch. Will carry. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3438. And open a work session, or a public hearing, excuse me, on House Bill 3316. Representative Gorsuch, you want to go around while Troy gives us a summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 3316, transfer duties, functions, and powers of Board of Directors of Mass Transit District, known as Tri-County Metropolitan Transportation District of Oregon, to governing body of Metropolitan Service District, known as Metro, declares emergency effective on passage. We are in receipt of -1 amendments, which modify the bill, which Representative Gorsuch will go over. Mr. Chairman, we are in receipt of all of the required paperwork.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Gorsuch. I'm the state rep from House District 49, which includes the cities of Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and Gresham. I'm happy to be here today in support of House Bill 3316. I have been working very hard to improve public transit for many years as both an advocate and an elected official. My most recent bill is before you. My most recent work is here. But I started looking at this seriously in terms of the governance issues when I was a Troutdale City Councilor between 2003 and the end of 2006. So I'd like to take a moment to allay some concerns that have been brought to me around this bill. First off, this bill is not in response to the current labor issues at TriMet, nor is it in response to any recent controversies that have been in the Oregonian. It's not an attack on transit or any of the current board members. This bill has simply one goal, and that is to create a board that is more responsive to TriMet riders by increasing local control. So, for many of us, going to work, the grocery store, the doctor's office is a matter of simply jumping in the car and driving there. However, there are many people in my district and across the metropolitan area who they only have one option, and that is to take public transit. So what might take drivers 15 to 20 minutes can take a transit rider two or three times as long. And some of that is obviously due to simply that transit moves more slowly, but the other part is due to the way bus lines are configured, the directions that they go. During our in-district day on March 29th, I met with the executive directors from the Rockwood building in my district. Their organizations provide medical care, Head Start, Meals on Wheels, and other services to people with low incomes, and also people in the senior category. Many of these people rely on public transit, and like many suburban areas, East Multnomah County's transit services can be few and far in between. I believe that the current method of appointments to the TriMet Board creates a board that's too insulated from the people they serve. So House Bill 3316 is designed to fix, or at least to help fix this problem, by providing appointing authority to local governments, which hopefully then gives riders more access to the people making the decisions that affect their daily lives. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Representative Gorsuch? Representative Cameron, then Representative Davis.
Mr. Chair, we have several people lined up.
Okay. Yes, we do. Thank you, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Can you talk about how they're currently appointed and what the bill would change that?
So currently, that's a very good question, Representative Davis. Currently, the appointment is done by the governor. And once the governor appoints someone, then it has to be, that person has to be confirmed by the Senate. And so that process is fairly far back from voters, and my whole concern here is that, you know, people aren't terribly likely to recall a governor because they don't like TriMet, but they may be able to have more influence and control if it was a county commissioner or a city councilor that had appointed that particular individual to the board. So it brings it closer to that group.
Other questions?
Okay. Representative Gorsuch, come on around. We've got
Thank you, Chair.
A number of other people. I think it would make sense to start with the TriMet General Manager, Neil McFarland, who's here. And then maybe we'll bring up the rest in panels. Thank you for coming, sir.
Thank you, Chair Reed and members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here and testify on House Bill 3316. And thank you, Representative Vice Chair Gorsuch, again, for your interest and your support of transit historically within our region. This is my first opportunity to actually address
I was waiting to see whether you were going to introduce yourself for the record.
I was. Thank you. Neil McFarland, TriMet General Manager.
Thank you.
My apologies. My first opportunity to be in front of you at a 30,000-foot level, I wanted to review a little bit of where we are as the transit district in the Portland metropolitan area over the last 4 years, the difficult choices we've had to make, and a quick look at the future. And I recognize we're very limited on time, so I'll do this very quickly.
Thank you.
I recognize that past 4 years have been difficult for TriMet, its riders and its constituents and stakeholders. We've had service cuts, we've had fare increases, we've had layoffs, we've had labor difficulties, and this has led to a difficult situation for us responding to the growing needs and changing needs of our community. Those communities are desperate for more service, but TriMet is unable to respond to those additional needs until we control our cost structure, primarily by getting our health benefit in line with the rest of the marketplace. I also recognize that some of our partners and riders are not always happy with the choices TriMet makes in allocating service. I just would point out that TriMet actually represents a very diverse constituency. 570 square miles of service, 25 cities, 3 counties. We're urban, we're suburban, we're rural, we're rich, we're poor. Our riders come from all walks of life. They're commuters, they're seniors, they're college and high school students, and they're people with disabilities. The other thing that's important to know that over 50% of our revenue comes from employer-based payroll tax, and the rest, 25%, comes from our operating base of fares. The challenge that we have is finding the balance between do we provide service based on who pays, on who most needs the rides, or on who would ride if the service is there. And those are different parameters that work differently in every part of our community. So it's a complex challenge and it's ever-changing. This is why nearly three years ago, when I became general manager, I asked that we take a relook at transit throughout the region, and we are in the midst of that process right now. We broke the region into 5 sub-areas. The first we looked at was the West Side sub-area, and that sub-area plan, West Side Service Enhancement Plan, is nearly done. And Representative Gorsuch, you'll be pleased to know the East Side is next on our list to actually come back and focus on the East Side. And the East Side plan will focus on access to jobs and educational opportunities. It will be built on some of the recent initiatives among the regional partners in East Multnomah County, the East Portland Action Plan, the East Metro Connections Plan, East Portland in Motion, and the coming work led by Metro to look at options for high-capacity transit in the Powell Division Corridor. The goal of each of these looks in each of the sub-areas of our region, 5 different sub-areas, will be to help try to plan for the future, create a vision for the future, and connect to the communities that we serve. We want to know what their needs are and how TriMet can be best help. In the meantime, we're working to improve transit. We'll be the budget year ahead has service improvements in it. It also includes our partnership with a lot of local jurisdictions as well as the Oregon Department of Transportation to build sidewalks and safe crossings on our existing routes. And finally, despite what you may have heard, TriMet is still one of America's premier transit agencies. Ridership did continue to increase throughout the recession. We are now 9th in per capita ridership, and even though we're in the 25th largest metropolitan area, we are about 40% finished and on time and on budget with the Portland and Milwaukee project, a project that leveraged $750 million in discretionary federal funding and is creating 14,000 jobs at the same time and building a new bridge across the Willamette River. And recently, as part of TriMet's reinvestment in our bus fleet, a reinvestment that will be caught up by 2016, we launched four new state-of-the-art hybrids, one of which was parked in front of the Capitol on Transit Day last week. And while clearly TriMet has struggled through this recession, you should know that TriMet is not alone. Let me give you a few examples. Pittsburgh, which is similar in size to Portland, provides 65 million rides a year compared to 100 million rides in Portland. In 2010, Pittsburgh cut 45 routes, or 35% of its service. In Atlanta, during the Great Recession, MARTA, the transit agency that serves that region, cut 700 positions, 30% of its bus service, and 14% of its rail service. In King County, the agency that serves the metropolitan Seattle area, they passed an actual $20 per vehicle surcharge on vehicle registration to keep the agency afloat during the Great Recession. This year, with the expiration of that surcharge, King County Metro faces a $75 million budget gap, which translates to about a 17% service reduction.
And Mr. McFarland, I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm sort of thinking, I'm looking at the clock and the remainder of our agenda today. The background is helpful. It looks like you're reading, and we're happy to take the background. Are there any, I imagine there are a number of questions for you, but would you like to make any comments about the bill specifically?
Let me just get to that. I would say that these are difficult times, difficult choices, and our board that we have is well suited to the situation we have at hand. Let me just give you three examples of our board members and why they're so well qualified and so important to TriMet. Our board chair, Bruce Warner, has been past director for the Portland Development Commission, for the Oregon Department of Transportation, similar positions at the City of Hillsborough. Brings an extreme level of help and assistance and background to his position. Travis Stovall, who represents East Multnomah County, is the president of the Stovall Group, independent business consulting, looking to help companies grow and reorganize. He's also an experienced healthcare executive, and that actually is one of our key problems, so he brings a great deal of expertise in that area as well. He's also been recognized for service to the Gresham Area Chamber of Commerce and the executive director of the East Metro Economic Alliance. A third example is Dr. T. Allen Bethel, who's the senior pastor of the Maranatha Church of God and involved in many civic activities, including boards of Warner Pacific College and chairs the Albina Ministerial Alliance, amongst others. So our board members serve their districts well. They bring unique qualifications and experience to the board of directors. For that reason, we oppose the bill. We believe that changing the board structure does nothing to address the underlying problems of adequate resources for transit service and growing transit service in this region. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thanks for your patience, Chair Reed and members of the committee.
Thank you. And we'll take questions, but I would note for the benefit of the committee, there are seven other people who have signed up to testify, including Senator Shields. So questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is too short of a day, or excuse me, there's too much on the agenda to get to all the questions that I may have or others may have.
That's true.
And I want to thank Mr. McFarland for coming here, but you mentioned a lot of things, but in your opening, you talked about a challenge is to get cost under control, and you said you've been there for 3 years, and obviously we have, last I looked, over $900 million, maybe $1 billion in unfunded liability for retirement health care that TriMet is on the hook. And what has been done in the last 3 years to work on the top priority that you're talking about? It's great to look at all the future services, but I'd like to hear about the cost control measures that you're putting in place to actually afford the services we're giving today.
So let me just note that the key to that obligation is the benefit itself. And so we have been working diligently through the collective bargaining process to try to address the value of the benefit itself. Frankly, financing the benefit is not the issue. The issue is beginning to get the benefit to be sustainable over a long period of time. And in that regard, we did have an arbitration decision last August that was favorable to TriMet that actually changed the health care benefit for the first time in probably a couple decades. We have much more work to do. We have a proposal that has been advanced to our union and actually is posted on our website that would also substantially reduce that benefit. But this is going to take a number of years. It took TriMet, as we often say, 30 years to get into this position. It's going to take us a few years to get out. And okay. So we're working to reduce the benefit.
Thank you. And maybe these are things you can come back and talk to us someday in the interim about. But you also mentioned you compared TriMet to Pittsburgh, King County, and a few others, and it would be great to have the financial packages of the employees in those particular areas compared to what we're paying in the TriMet area. I don't expect that answer today.
I suspect that's something they can get to us.
Great. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Davis and Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your testimony today. I'm just trying to put the need or the potential need for this board change in context, and just looking at some of the numbers over the weekend, actually, that TriMet has been dealing with. And tell me if this is correct. So fiscal year 04 to 05, comparing fiscal year 12 to 13, passenger fares have actually increased 97% in that time. Payroll tax revenue has gone up 43% in that time. Total operating resources are up 51%. Therefore, total resources be about 125% increase in a nine-year or eight-year fiscal period. Does that sound about right? That's numbers from your reports.
I'd have to verify the numbers, but
I appreciate that. But the broader point being that came from TriMet's financial information. So we're seeing an increase in revenue, a decrease in service in some instances, many instances, especially for buses. If you had to trace that back to one thing or a couple factors, could you crystallize that, what those factors would be?
Absolutely. Number one is during the Great Recession, there was a substantial reduction in the projected growth in the payroll tax, as much as the state saw with the income tax. So that's number one. But number two is that we do have, and I've been very clear about this in public statements, an unsustainable health care benefit for our union employees. Again, our union employees do all the work of the agency, and they do an incredible job, but there are 2,100 of them. With a health care plan that originally started when I began this tenure as general manager with a $5 copay and no deductibles and no out-of-pocket maximum, you can imagine the costs. We pay about $30,000 a year for family coverage. So what you have is a situation with healthcare costs increasing more than the CPI for everybody, but for us even more dramatically. In addition to that, as Representative Cameron noted, we have retirement healthcare responsibilities, and we're probably no different than every other workforce in the nation, where we have actually a bubble of older people who are beginning to retire. So we have both increasing numbers of retirees and increasing healthcare costs that has created a burden that has actually grown much faster than any of the revenue sources. And I've been very clear to say that this fundamentally isn't a revenue problem. This is a cost problem here that we need to deal with within the agency.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I guess I have some concerns. I actually don't have a lot of heartburn with the bill, but I'm curious why TriMet would, I mean, you talked about we don't have money, so therefore we oppose the bill. That's kind of what I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, so you don't want to see this expanded. But somebody, I don't know who the map fairy was, that brought me a very nice map of my house district with the map lines of how much TriMet service we get. But it's a little loop on one side, and it's a little line on the other side, and we put a lot of money into TriMet. So I'd like you to re-articulate for me why you wouldn't want to see a board expanded and bring in more people into the board who are currently not being serviced very well by TriMet. And the other piece of this is that, you know, Wilsonville, Sandy, Malala, others have done a pretty good models of small transit, cross-suburban transit, works really well in those communities, and TriMet is not getting that done in my district. So please re-articulate for me why this is a bad idea.
Representative Parrish, I appreciate the question very much. Come back and say is that this changing the appointment of the board doesn't create more revenue that allows us or reduce costs by itself. that allows us to grow more service. That's where we all want to be, I suspect, amongst all of us, which is we'd like to see more service growth within the TriMet region. So this does nothing to address that fundamental imbalance between costs and revenues over time. Second, I would say that we are working hard to look for some different models of service delivery. One example is in the Tualatin area, where we are working with the Chamber of Commerce to create the Tualatin, to expand the service of the Tualatin shuttle. We've actually enlisted the help of the federal government with some additional funding to help provide that service that actually is critical to a number of employers. And I was there at a chamber meeting probably a couple weeks ago, where again was hearing from the employers in that area about how critical it is to get access to, particularly for lower or entry-level wage earners, into the employment market there. So we have a number of innovative models around the region, but we do have some real constraints now, and my point being that changing the appointment of the board doesn't address those overall constraints. You would see our board completely dedicated to the notion of bringing costs and revenues in a better alignment.
There are seven people to testify. Please be quick.
I guess I'm going to circle back to the piece of why more isn't better, and that my big concern, besides not having very good transit, and why I would like to see more representation from my counties on there, is there's a lot of push around to the suburban communities that we're not doing enough for low-income housing. But the fact of it is that you can't do the low-income housing if the transportation doesn't support it. And so I think having more representation on that board does not solve your fiscal problems. I'd love to solve your fiscal problems. Don't get me wrong. We've had that conversation. But the fact of it is that when I look at the makeup of the board, and it is very Portland-heavy, that does not serve the needs of people in my community on both counties. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's move to the rest of the folks who want to testify. Thank you, sir. Senator Shields, if you'd like to join us, I'm going to call a couple other people while you're getting settled. Les Poole and Roxanne Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief because I got to get back to the Health Care Committee in Hearing Room A. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate, District 22. And I'm here today because I am supportive of House Bill 3316. For this general reason, I think as a general rule, I believe the more democracy, the better, and that the public interest is best served when it's closer to the people. I support TriMet's current board, particularly the job done by my constituent, Dr. T. Allen Bethel. This bill isn't about the current board, nor is this bill about management versus labor. I think I completely support the tough job that our drivers are doing at TriMet, and I think it's also important for us to realize, and this hasn't been brought out in the media, that while they might have a decent health care package, they're not PERS members, and there are other benefits that they're not being able to take advantage of. But again, this bill isn't about labor versus management. This bill isn't about the board. It's not about what the job that the board is doing today, but instead is about how best to do the people's business tomorrow and beyond. I believe that the more democracy, the better. The closer to the pulse of the people, the better. And I support the bill on that basis. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Who'd like to go next?
I need to get back to committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Les Poole. I live in Gladstone. Grew up in East Portland and watched the construction of the light rail line there. Actually voted for the West Side Light Rail Line and have become a staunch opponent of how things are going at TriMet these days, and a very vocal and informed opponent of the Milwaukee Light Rail Line. I know that's not today's issue, but it's the poster child for what's wrong with TriMet. The lady commented a few minutes ago that the board is very Portland heavy. It certainly is. And whenever you've got an entity that is dominated by a certain geographic area, let's use Portland dominating the rural side of the mountain, you have a recipe for trouble. And I support the changes that have been introduced into this bill so that we have some diversification. Diversity is the most abused word in the world. I won't use it the rest of my testimony. I truly think that the appointment of the board by the governor tends to send one type of person there. And regardless of who's governor now, we get down the road a few years, maybe things change, and now you've got a governor appointing people of a different venue, when really we need the public who is paying for this to be involved. And anything we can do to bring more local control, God, there's another buzzword, I apologize, but the sooner that we do that, the better. I want everyone in this room to know that in 2005, one thing that caught my eye was the TriMet board voted to double their salary to $200,000 a year. How much public input was there in that process? Most of you probably don't know that even occurred. I'll conclude here and keep it brief. Every one of the fiscal issues and labor issues that we are dealing with TriMet currently, correct me if I'm wrong, but every one of them was approved by a board. I've attended board meetings at TriMet, and they're very vanilla. Generally, things just get approved. And when you do business that way long enough, pretty soon the bills come due. Pretty soon you get a reality check. I don't believe that moving TriMet laterally under Metro's control is going to fix a thing. But certainly, let's make some changes. They're long overdue. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Poole. And Representative Doherty, you're now appointed to the to determining what was a an overused word. But we'll wait for the sound when it.
Ms. Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Representative.
Thank you, everyone, for letting us testify. My name is Roxanne Ross, and I live in Gresham in Metro District 1. I commuted by TriMet for 7 years. I agree that we need more public input to the board, like an elected board, instead of an appointed board. But I think it would be a grievous error to put it under Metro. Metro is a government vehicle that takes away local control from the citizens in the name of convenience and standardization. There are, I think, 27 local governments. There's, by Metro's website, there's 1.6 million people in their area. To have any influence on a Metro major, you must win in Portland, because the number of people there so dwarf the rest of the region. So the end result is that Metro is a vehicle to force absurd Portland liberal policies out on the rest of us from the suburban areas of the other areas outside of Portland. Metro already has way too much power. Please do not give it any more power. We have lost local control by agreeing to Metro years ago. Metro is the bull in the China cabinet. It has bullied Clackamas County over transportation. Portland to Milwaukee Light Rail was voted down locally twice in 96 and 98, but a couple of years later, Metro began planning on it again. The people of Clackamas County have had to go to extraordinary lengths at the ballot box through the initiative process, winning with overwhelming margins, but Metro just keeps pushing it. They don't care. It has bullied Troutdale over the environment, little old Troutdale up against Metro. Bullies need less power, not more power. Metro bullies neighborhoods. Metro has these 3D maps on their website. You can go and look it up, where they show where they want to put the transit-oriented development all over the metro region, in the downtowns of all the little cities. They work with developers to get taxpayer-funded assistance with the projects, big money, millions of dollars. I went to a neighborhood meeting of Wilshire and Beaumont neighborhood associations, and I saw neighbor after neighbor plead with the developer to add parking spots for cars. It was to be a 50-unit building with 55 bicycle spots and no car parking spots. And these poor neighbors, they thought it was the developer picking on them. It was Metro. It was Metro pushing transit-oriented development. And you've seen probably in the news that Charlie Hales did a work stoppage order on one of the developments. Bullies need less power, not more power. Please, we need more local control, not less. Do not put this under Metro. Do not pass this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Ross. We appreciate your testimony. Next up, Paulette Rossi, John Charles, and Steve Marsh, please. I'll let you three decide the order.
Hello, I'm Paulette Rossi, and I have been now transit dependent on TriMet since September 27, 1971. I have seen many TriMet boards. I have also served on the Portland Utility Review Board for 10 years, being appointed chair by Mayor Potter in 2008 and Mayor Adams in 2009. I learned that the best board members don't necessarily become best board members because they are chosen as civic leaders or business professionals and happen to be known by the elected officials. I found the best board members were simply passionate people who made the time to study each issue and be at every meeting. Too many TriMet board meetings operate with the bare minimum needed for a quorum. Often board members miss back-to-back meetings. The time commitment to being a board member is huge. Budget and finance can be taught to anyone, but finding the necessary time to be a good board member is very difficult. Your Bill 3316 asks for people to be good board members because they happen to be known by the governor. That doesn't necessarily make the best board member. The board must be made up instead of people that want to be board members. They are in a position to take the time because they actually run for the position. They run a campaign. They become familiar with the issues and with their constituents. They have the time then to serve. If they slack off after the election, we can also vote them out. Not only does an election and even the appearance of a political appointment, it ensures that positions are filled in a timely manner, just as school board positions are filled by the Oregon Revised Statutes governing elections. Appointments by high-level officials, by elected officials, are flattering to receive. They're also flattering to say yes to. It's very difficult to say no to an elected official, but it's very difficult to keep the time commitment to actually serve. There's an English proverb that says, what you work for the most, you hold most dearly. I would hope that the appointment system would end and we would have people have to work to receive the position.
Thank you, Ms. Rossi. I suspect that some of the people up here might quibble with your observation that it's difficult to say no to elected officials. Whoever would like to go next, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute, and a longtime transit rider and observer of TriMet governance. And this bill relates to the governance of TriMet, and I appreciate Representative Gorsuch in bringing this forward. And I agree that the board should be changed. But I also agree with Neil McFarland that actually doing that would have little effect by itself on the problems of the agency. I'd like to just briefly discuss why, and my handouts to you are simply three documents from TriMet's own financials, because if you look at them, you'll see why the problem is so severe. But you can see that they're completely upside down on their match between expenses and revenues. This particular document, which is probably future historians will refer to as TriMet's suicide note, describes that they can't survive. They will be completely collapsing within the next 15 years. But they imply that there's a window of opportunity between now and fiscal 2017, which I think is false, because if you look at the second page of the handout, you can see that they've been looting their trust funds. They're down $1.2 billion. These are trust funds. The money is supposed to be there for promises made to employees and past employees, and they're, the $900 million OPEB obligation is 0% funded. The other trust funds, 67% funded and 52% funded. The TriMet board meets twice a month. I'm pretty sure you don't wake up one day and discover, wow, $1.2 billion is gone. What happened? We're talking entire generations of board members showing up at meetings, looting the trust funds to pay for other stuff. That, to me, is a complete failure of governance, and it goes back over 20 years. So simply replacing board members by itself would not be enough because the agency is so deep into something. They owe so many people so much money that they can't unwind that actually you need to decide how you're going to reconfigure TriMet because they're not going to exist. And there's a key thing that I want to point out is I'm going to make some quotes here from TriMet's 20-year forecast published on their website in December, which is that revenue is not the problem. This is their CFO stating, TriMet's operating revenues per capita are 70% higher than peer agencies. The payroll tax is a reliable and growing source of revenue. You may know that the payroll tax rate goes up every January pursuant to your legislation and is likely to go up every January through 2024, also pursuant to your authorization. Passenger fares have grown by average of 6.8% annually over the past 10 years. It's not a revenue problem. In fact, as Representative Davis mentioned earlier, all funds budget went up 125% in the last 8 years and service went down 14%. Something of a bureaucratic miracle that revenue goes in and nothing comes out. Benefits versus wages. I mean, TriMet benefits are 157% of wages. I looked at the top 15 transit districts in the country. TriMet always wants to act like it's a big-time transit entity. Okay. There is no one even close to that. The second is New York City MTA, where benefits are 88% of wages. That followed by Washington, D.C. New Jersey Transit is at 83%. The lower end is Denver RTD at 34% and Miami-Dade County at 33%. So even in an industry known for high cost of labor, TriMet is completely off the chart, and there's not going to be a solution through traditional bargaining because the basic template has been approved and reapproved and reapproved by the board so many times. There's not going to be going back. So another problem, rail is unsustainable and cannibalizing bus service. Every time they build a rail project, and Milwaukee Light Rail is an example, they will be selling $60 million of bonds paid back by future payroll taxes, which cannibalizes their own general fund. And bondholders get paid before anybody else does. And the third chart I show you is the senior lien debt chart. That is that when they have all this debt piles up, the payroll tax money goes into trust funds and then goes out to Wall Street bondholders. TriMet never even gets to touch it. So bondholders will get theirs, but what happens to actual riders? And the key thing that I only discovered recently in their 20-year forecast is that in 2027, just as the gap between operations revenue and expenses is as widest, they will have to float $327 million in revenue bonds in fiscal year 27 to replace 36 of the original rail cars and purchase 12 new ones. And at that point, this senior lien debt chart completely blows up, and they simply won't exist if they even are around to that point. So they've broken promises to everybody. They promised you when you authorized increased payroll taxes in 03, the service would go up. In fact, it's gone down. They promised employees for benefits upon retirement, and there's no money in the trust fund, or at least one of the big trust funds. And they promised FTA when they took federal money for light rail lines they would have levels of service, and those levels of service are not there. Both the yellow line and the green line, they're violating their full funding grant agreements. So to me, the TriMet board has no credibility. And as far as what to do with this bill, I have a couple specific recommendations. One is I urge you to resist the usual temptation to have a one-and-done hearing and forget about it and procrastinate, because the legislature and the TriMet board have been procrastinating for 2 decades, and the problem's not going to go away. I think you should create a little work group, vow to do something, and you should replace the current TriMet board, some version of Representative Gorsuch's bill,
You should begin to shrink the district to a more sustainable size by allowing a lot of other suburban communities to opt out, which is now extremely difficult. You should prohibit TriMet from selling any revenue bonds, which would allow them only GO bonds. And the advantage there is GO bonds require a vote, and the money comes from, if it passes, from a property tax assessment that does not affect TriMet's general fund, which revenue bonds do. And fourth, I would say, looking at this second sheet here, I would say you should force TriMet in a bill to pick a number for this OPEB trust fund that has 0%. Pick a number between 0 and 78 million, which is what the actuaries say they should be putting in, a number between 0 and 78, and mandate that they put something greater than 0 into that trust fund starting immediately, because they're not doing it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Charles.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve March. I'm the Multnomah County Auditor, but I'm not here in my official capacity. I'm here as a citizen representing myself. You've got my written testimony. I'm not going to read it to you and insult your intelligence about that. You've heard a lot of discussion about the board is a good board. I have no quibbles with the board members. I have no problem with the governor. However, if I have a concern about TriMet, it's not likely that I'm going to call the governor to get him to put some pressure on the board to take action. I think the Dash 1 amendments prepared will put a lot closer accountability to local officials who are accountable to the voters, and I would urge your passage. Thank you.
Thank you. We have one more person to testify. It is John Hummel, please.
Chair Reed, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is John Hummel. I'm the State and Federal Policy Director for the Oregon Primary Care Association. OPCA is a nonprofit membership organization comprising Oregon's 201 community health centers. Our health centers operate clinics throughout the state that provide coordinated care to primarily Medicaid patients and uninsured patients. Many of our patients in the Tri-County area rely on TriMet to travel to our health centers, yet rider and rider advocates are underrepresented on the TriMet board. Additionally, in light of the current gubernatorial appointment process, riders and rider advocates have limited opportunities to successfully advocate for greater representation on the board. The experience of community health centers is instructive when you consider the Dash 1 amendments that are in front of you now. Community health centers were established by the Federal Public Health Service Act. That act requires a majority of board members for community health centers to be consumers of those health centers. So the majority of our boards throughout the state are comprised of Medicaid patients or uninsured patients. What have we learned from that? Well, here's what we've learned. There's certainly a lot more effort required on the front end to orient a low-income patient, someone who's otherwise marginalized or vulnerable. You have to provide a lot more assistance on the front end to get them up to speed on the board processes, procedures, accounting skills, how to review budgets. Absolutely, there's more work required on the front end. But on the back end, it's clear that the results that have been experienced by our health centers are greatly enhanced as a result of having consumers on the board. The operations of our health centers, the patient experiences in our health centers, and the health outcomes received by the patients in our health centers are all positively impacted by the involvement of patients on our boards. We are confident that enhanced participation of rider and rider advocates on TriMet's board would produce similar positive results. So please vote yes on the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3316. Doing so will provide a meaningful voice to TriMet riders and will improve the experience of riders throughout the TriMet region. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, sir. That completes the list of folks to testify on House Bill 3316. Representative Gorsuch, did you want to describe the Dash 1 amendments in more detail?
Yeah, in the original bill, It was, as the one woman discussed, the suggestion was to move TriMet under Metro's control. The Dash 1 amendments changed that so that it would be...
I suppose I should interrupt for a second.
Oh, yeah.
Just close the public hearing
and
open a work session on House Bill 3316. So you can continue your description. My apologies.
So we moved away from the Metro appointment and moved to a situation where the regional governments, so the three counties, City of Portland, Metro, and the governor will all have appointments. Everybody gets two except for the governor, which he will get one. And that way, as some have testified, we hope to bring it closer to the people that TriMet serves. So that's the Dash 1 amendment, and I'd like to move that we accept the Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3316. Is there a discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Gorsuch.
Mr. Chair, I would, since we do still have some things to work out in terms of how many people are representing from the various areas around the metropolitan area, I think that we should move the bill to the Rules Committee without a recommendation so that we can finish that work.
Is that a motion?
That is a motion, sir.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch moves that House Bill 3316 be referred to the Committee on Rules without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. House Bill 3316 is referred to the Committee on Rules without recommendation. Close the work session on House Bill 3316. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2945. Representative Cameron, if you'd like to join us, we appreciate your patience. Please feel free to bring anyone you'd like with you, and Troy can give us a summary.
House Bill 2945 directs Clackamas County to propose on or before September 30th, 2014, a charter for formation of Area Commission on Transportation for portion of county outside boundary of Metro and Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, known as JPAC. Directs county to submit charter to the Oregon Transportation Commission. Directs county to report on development of area commission to interim committees of Legislative Assembly on or before October 31st, 2014. Requires charter to include provision allowing governing body of Hood River County to opt out. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we are in possession of, I believe, Dash 2 amendments.
Thank you, Troy. Senator Thompson, my apologies. I didn't see you sneak in, so I will call you.
Oh, I was hiding. Don't worry.
Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, co-vice chairs and members of the committee. For the record, Bill Kenemer, State Representative, District 39. Thank you for this hearing, this opportunity to talk about, I think, a very important item for a lot of us. With reapportionment, I found that I suddenly was representing a substantial area of rural Clackamas County. And I was promptly contacted by some of my long-term activist friends from particularly the Molino community. And they were concerned that they thought that they were the only folks in the entire state without representation in an act. And they had had a number of incidents, and they will detail that a little bit in their testimony, where they felt like they needed to have a better voice. As we looked into that, they also said that Hood River County was not included. And so that's the nature of the bill. It seems that Clackamas County has 129,000 folks not represented, and 93.5% of the third largest county in the state is outside of an act. And there are, within Clackamas County, 287 miles of state highway. So there are some issues. As we contacted Hood River to see their wishes, they said they were very supportive of this, and the senator can speak to this because actually he did most of this work, but they would like to have the option of maybe joining at a later time. As we explored the idea of creating an act for this area without an act, we found a couple of issues. One was that portions in Clackamas County are subject to being eventually included in ever larger segments of the urban growth boundary. And so we created an amendment to say that if these areas of this act are brought into the urban area, they are automatically withdrawn from the act, which only makes good sense. Secondly, we met in March at our request with some members of ODOT. As we met, they talked about the need for a more comprehensive act. And when we discussed that, we found out that there are actually small portions of East Multnomah County and some portions of Washington County that are currently outside the act. So that's when we did the Dash 2 amendments, which deal with the urban growth boundary, and following the model with Hood River County makes it optional for these to join in too, which amounts to perhaps 170,000 folks is our current estimate. A lot of folks. I'm excited about the bill. I appreciate the hearing. I think you're going to hear some great testimony. I think it's time for us to bring public process, representation, and fairness to the folks of this area. And I would point out a couple of other things. The bill is sponsored by nearly all of the people who have any contact representing Clackamas County. And the reason for that is I dropped the bill before learning about Multnomah and Washington counties and Hood River, although they're supportive, they're not actively involved. So that's the reason you have Clackamas County sponsors. I also would indicate, and you'll hear from the board chair soon, that this is endorsed strongly by the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners and along with the cities of Canby, Sandy, and Malala. So I ask that you please help the orphans of these four counties find an act. I like that line. Let me just repeat it. I worked on this one a long time.
We'll give you some help. Yeah, try it again.
Please help the orphans of these four counties find an act.
Are we ready? You know what? He'll be here all session.
Chair, thank you. Senator Thompson is here, and of course, we're open for questions.
Senator Thompson, follow that.
Thank you. I'm not even going to try it. Normally, I'm pretty good, but not.
Usually not going to beat that one.
Thank you, Chair Reed and Vice Chair Gorsuch. Thanks for having me today. I'm here to support Representative Kimmer. I also represent many people in rural Clackamas County, East Multnomah County, also that aren't in the act. I also represent Hood River County, has not been in the act. As a county commissioner, we tried this about 3 years ago. And we just—they haven't quite got there yet in Hood River County. They support the Dash 2, which allows them to come in at a later time. I think this will help to spur some further conversation, and hopefully ODOT and all of us folks can maybe get together. Or we can get our act together.
I wasn't mowing my yard this weekend.
You kind of sandbagged it. Said he didn't have a line, and then he brought that one out at the end. All right. Okay. So we've got a number of people to testify. Are there any questions for the senator or the representative? I don't see any.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much. So I'm just going to proceed down the list. I know there are some people who wanted to be at the same time, but given that we have three chairs there, that may or may not work. Clackamas County Chair John Ludlow, Gary Schmidt from Clackamas County, and Mayor Debbie Rogge from Malala, please. My apologies for the pronunciation.
Well, Senator Thompson would say that's a tough pair to follow.
Golly. Spell that, Mr. Chair.
Chair Reed, esteemed commissioner, I'll get this right, representatives, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify before your committee. Some things have already been said, so
Mr.
I won't
Chair,
be redundant.
I need to have you introduce yourself for the record, please.
I'm John Ludlow, Chair of the Clackamas County Commission.
Thank you.
And much like we often vote, I'm here representing the commission on a 5-0 vote. I'm pleased to appear here before you today. In 1996, the Oregon Transportation Commission created ACTS in order to expand opportunities for local citizen involvement in ODOT's decision-making. The OTC's guiding policy document on ATC formation states, because ACTs are primary advisors to OTC with regards to transportation policies and programs which affect them, the OTC strongly encourages coverage of the state with respect to ACT and MPO. Now, as has been previously stated, we're the only area uncovered Today, all areas of Oregon are represented by either an act or a metropolitan planning organization, except the areas that have been previously described. That is some, of course, in Washington and Multnomah counties, and, of course, Hood River County. Now, in 2011, we thought we'd had a deal with ODOT where we'd be able to form our act, and at the last minute, they threw in Hood River County, who did not have the assets or the manpower to join, and so it threw the whole thing out yet again. For over 10 years, we've worked on this. House Bill 2945 would resolve this issue by providing residents and transportation interests in the area with a voice in ODOT decision-making process, something that all other residents, again, of the state enjoy. This is not about new monies and us going after new monies and deciding where new monies are at. We just want to have a weigh-in on where these monies are going. With all the roads, state-funded roads that we have in our county, especially in the rural sections, we need a weigh-in on what priorities should be. Now, let me address, and the big things I want to address are ODOT's complaints about this. First, ODOT is concerned that the bill will lead to the creation of several small acts in ODOT Region 1. This is not the case. The bill would be the foundation for only two potential acts. The bill and the proposed amendment would create an act for those areas of Clackamas County outside the metro boundary, would allow other areas of ODOT Region 1, specifically again Multnomah and Washington counties and Hood River counties, to join in if they desire. The bill leaves the portion of ODOT Region 1 inside the metro boundaries alone also, and they can form their own act. So the maximum of two more acts, and again, the representation is key here. Second, although ODOT has said that they are open to the creation of two acts within ODOT Region 1, they prefer to create one mega act for the entire region. This would create a single act for approximately 1.7 million people, almost 44% of the state's population, when 11 acts exist to serve the remaining population of the state. We do not believe that the rural interests would be well served in an act at this time and would likely be dominated by the needs of the urban areas, much like it is now. But lastly, ODOT has stated that there may not be enough transportation diversity within the area to merit its own act. We say there isn't enough inclusion for the diversity that we do have. We disagree with that statement. The proposed act would cover 60% of Clackamas County state highways. This has been mentioned by Representative Kennemer, 287 miles. This area includes I-5, U.S. 26, Oregon 99E, 211, 212, 213, and 224, as well as several transit districts and one of the state's largest tourist designations, and that is Mount Hood. The area's transportation infrastructure is vital for the movement of people, freight, and delivery of critical services and agricultural and forest products throughout the Portland area. This diversity would increase if Hood River County and the areas of Washington and Multnomah counties join in the proposed act. And finally, an act would provide a forum for all governments and transportation interests to decide together how limited transportation funds should be spent, leading to more strategic investments in the area's transportation networks. There's an old lobbyist who used to hang around here named John Chandler. He said it best.
I think he's still here.
Yeah.
He's older.
I noticed that. He, at least he's got here, like me. And that is, if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu. And we feel like we've been on the menu long enough. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who's next?
Hi, Chair Reed and members of the committee. My name's Deborah Rogge. I'm mayor of the city of Mooloolah. We're about 8,100 little individuals, a very, very small community. And the reason that I came before you today, in addition to what's been already said, I won't repeat, and you have my testimony. Mooloolah has a large block of undeveloped industrial lands. And as Metro grows, more and more people are moving to the rural areas just to get away from the expansion and or to have a little piece of life there. And, you know, when you go to the grocery store, you jump in the car, you go get your groceries. Well, in Mooloolah, the main grocery store closed here about 3 months ago due to the economy. That leaves us one Safeway on the very edge of town. And unfortunately, only access to that one grocery store is Highway 211 and 213. At least a quarter mile on either side of that grocery store access, there are very deep ditches and a shoulder that's no wider than this, a gravel shoulder. We need to get sewer, storm drain, we need lights, and we need sidewalks. Until now, Mooloolah was unwilling to fund or help partner fund any enhancements on these highways, but now we're in a place now where we're almost to an emergent need, and I have spent some time with Senator Girard on this issue. We're willing to put urban renewal funds towards this, but unfortunately our little voice and our emergent need is drowned out by the metro needs and the other needs in Region 1. We know very specifically what we need in Malala, where we can partner, what communities we can work with, and we could save a lot of money and wasted assets if we would have a voice at the table or have a forum to be very clear about what our needs are. So this act would be the first opportunity our local community would have, as well as other communities around us. So I appreciate your time and energy, and I highly recommend that you support this H. Bill 2945. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Chair Reed, I'd like to make sure to introduce Gary Schmidt, our head of public affairs and government affairs. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Thank you.
Before we hear from him, I want to list the folks who might be on deck. Scott Lazenby, Brian Hodson, mayor from Canby, and Mike Wagner from Molino.
Any questions? He's not going to speak.
Oh, all right. Very good.
A question. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So let's go to that next group. Lazenby, Brian Hodson, Mike Wagner, please.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I'm Scott Lazenby, city manager for the City of Sandy. City of Sandy does support this bill. Mayor Bill King, our Sandy mayor, has submitted a letter in support. I don't have a lot to add. Beyond that, we've been in support of some kind of act for the rural area for years. Even though what we're looking at is just a portion of ODOT Region 1, the population represented is larger than that of many of the other acts in the state. So we do support it, and we look forward to working with Clackamas County to forward something to the OTC to consider.
Thank you, sir. Who's next?
Let's go.
My name is Mike Wagner, and I live in Molino. And the hamlets and villages have worked in the rural areas for quite a while to form an act so that we can be represented before the Oregon Transportation Commission. As in the prior testimony indicated, that we did work for 2 years to form an act and try to form one with Hood River County, and they... I guess in the memo, it was joining a more populated area with more active stakeholders, rural Clackamas County, with the less populated areas, Hood River County and eastern rural Multnomah County, can be unsettling due to the impacts on time, money, and project prioritization. I think as a person of rural Clackamas County, I feel the same way as Hood River did in terms of wanting to be part of a super act with Metro. And I appreciate the earlier testimony on the character of Metro. I kind of have a tendency to agree with that, and we don't think that this act should be part of Metro. We know that Region 1 is reluctant to support the legislation, but if all the regions felt the way Region 1 did, there would probably be no acts in the state. And I know that acts are a good way for regions to communicate with their customers. Also, on May 31st, 2011, ODOT Region 1 committed to the Oregon Transportation Commission to work with Clackamas County to set up meetings with rural Clackamas County stakeholders on a semi-annual or quarterly basis. It's almost been 2 years now, and we haven't heard anything from Region 1. Clackamas County made every attempt to be represented on the interim STIP without any success. At a Clackamas County Coordinating Committee C4, Donna Jordan, a councilwoman from Lake Oswego, stated that the interim STIP would be a good place to show rural Clackamas County how the urban areas might be able to work with them. The net result was no representation by rural citizens on the interim STIP. Respectfully request that we not be put under Metro's thumb. In that way, we ensured that there would be no representation. I'd also like to point out that we really are a grassroots effort that has really worked its way up, starting just our meeting together as citizens and as hamlets and villages and CPOs, and convincing the staff to work on this and convincing the Board of County Commissioners that this is justifiable. And we're here today. We've tried to form an act. We've tried to be on the interim STIP, and we would like you to make this right for us. And as you can see, a majority of the cities in the rural area are supporting this act. And I'd just like to say that rural needs are just very different than urban needs.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed and members of the committee.
For the record, my name is Brian Hodson. I'm the mayor of the city of Canby, and I thank you for the opportunity here to appear before you today on behalf of the city of Canby to voice our support for House Bill 2945. My speaking points are there in front of you, and much of them are very similar to the points that you've already heard. For us in Canby, my perception has been is that ACTS have played a major role in transportation efforts throughout Oregon and the Portland metro area. And as Canby is a growing industrial community, as well as a overall just residential area, that helps play into the connectivity piece as we grow. Secondly, transportation, all modes, not just vehicles and freight, connect rural communities to the larger community base and to cities and to each other. As you heard from Mayor Raggi, Canby and Malala have already started working relationships in certain areas, and we want to see that continue as well as trickle down to the smaller communities outside, the Molino community being one of those. In closing, I just want to say at the end of the day, the creation of the Act for the rural communities will provide us with the opportunity to have a seat at the table, provide a voice, and be involved in this important process. As communities outside the metro boundary grow, so will those multimodal transportation needs and desires. We want to be able to be engaged in a more participatory and collaborative leadership role that shape these transportation needs and ultimately lead to solutions. These solutions will support community growth, connectivity, and job creation as those employment lands and communities become more accessible. So I encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Next up, Stephen Bates, Bill Merchant, and Warren Jones, I think. And as you gentlemen get settled, Bob Reeves will be on deck. Whoever would like to go first, please begin by identifying yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gorsuch, Vice Chair Bentz. My name's Stephen Bates. I'm the chair of the Boring Community Planning Organization. I wish to share some thoughts concerning the lack of an area committee on transportation in rural Clackamas County. Boring is an unincorporated area on the fringe of the metropolitan Portland area. We are rural, but we have a voice with JPAC. Only half of us do. Half of Boring is outside of Metro. As a result, we have no voice. So I'm here saying that part of us are having a voice with JPAC, but of course JPAC doesn't pay much attention to Boring anyway. But the other part of Boring has no representation whatsoever. As a result, the Boring Community Planning Organization voted unanimously to support the passage of House Bill 2945. ODOT's website states that ACTS address all aspects of transportation and they work with other local organizations dealing with transportation-related issues. Furthermore, ACTS were formed to expand opportunities for local citizen involvement in ODOT's decision-making. With the situation that we have with Metro and JPAC, that's not really being taken care of, but the rural communities in Clackamas County can be more involved with their own act. The residents of rural Clackamas County are not receiving the privileges afforded to other citizens throughout the state. Please be aware that Gales Creek has ACT representation. The people of Eagle Creek do not. Juntura has ACT representation. The residents of George do not. Jasper, outside of Springfield, has ACT representation. Cottrell, outside of Boring, does not. The list goes on and on. There are communities in Clackamas County that do not have the ability to be involved in the transportation decision-making process. On behalf of the people of Boring and in the interest of fairness and equity, I respectfully request that this committee pass this bill on with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Who's next?
Bill. Go. I'm Bill Merchant. I am the vice chair of the hamlet of Beaver Creek, just outside of Oregon City. We are a rural community. We are right next to the urban area, we get lots and lots of traffic, and we have no voice in where that traffic can go or what it can do. So I've been working with the other hamlets and villages for a long time now to try to get an act going. We thought we had something going a couple of years ago, and it fell apart, so we're trying again through the legislature to try to get an act together. One of the things that concerns me is Mount Hood. Mount Hood is a resource for the entire state, and it is not covered by an act. ODOT pays a lot of attention to Highway 26, of course, but there's an awful lot of other highways and traffic going around Mount Hood that are ignored, or if ODOT doesn't want to pay any attention to them, they are ignored. And I think it's vital that we have an act to deal with Mount Hood, southern Clackamas County that produces lots and lots of agriculture, none of which have any kind of representation. Thank you.
Chair Reed, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Warren Jones. I reside in Malina, Oregon, and I'm the guy that kind of about 10, 11 years ago raised this question originally to the then County Commissioner Martha Schrader and to Senator Schrader about saying, what's an act? I had no idea that they existed, and why don't we have one? It's been a long journey for a lot of us. It, as pointed out by others, it was citizen-driven. We are really trying to look forward as acts as being a long-term planning tool. They're not going to pave a local road in a year or two, but to looking forward about how we can facilitate better movement of, by all means of modes of transportation is essential to us, especially in South Clackamas County, where forest products and farm products provide a long distance to be able to get their products to market. And most of the rest of the facts that have been presented, I support. I don't want to repeat those. I do ask you to please move this forward with a do pass recommendation, and I hope you do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones, and thanks for your excellent multitasking. We were trying to give you stage directions. You did well. Yeah. Very good.
You're welcome.
Last up, Bob Reeves, please.
Chair Reed, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee.
Same direction for you. Move the microphone away from your mouth a little bit and then open the story. There you go.
There we go.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Chair Reed. My name is Bob Reeves. I live in Welch's, up on the mountain, Mount Hood, and I chair the villages at Mount Hood. I also chair the Mountain Express bus line. We run a line from Sandy up to Rhododendron 6 days a week. Both committees have unanimously endorsed the letter that has been submitted to your committee. I strongly endorse this bill. Hope you do a due pass and move it forward, and I support everything that's been said. I don't think it's necessary to keep repeating the same thing in the interest of time, but if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. And we will now hear from Matt Garrett, Director of ODOT.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts because I've listened closely to what the good folks have said, and I want you to know we have, I think, a very strong partnership with Clackamas County, the communities that make up Clackamas County, so you can look at some of the activities that have transpired as we've done safety issues up on Mount Hood along the Highway 26 corridor, coming down 205, just looking at the family of projects we work very closely with Clackamas County to deliver, whether it is the Sunnyside, Sunnybrook, the Monterey, moving out to 213, culminating with the Oregon City West Lynn Arch Bridge Tunnel. So the partnership is strong. So I come to the table with some anxiety after listening to these folks because I believe that the intent of the House Bill 2945 is simply to allow the voices to be heard, those voices that right now don't believe they are heard, to allow these voices to find a place at a table, at a forum, to debate the various transportation projects, the programs, the policies and practices we have in play. And I want you to know that I embrace and strongly subscribe to the intent and that type of outcome here. But unfortunately, I disagree with the approach of House Bill 2945 to engage an ACT conversation up for the greater Oregon ODOT Region 1 area here. I have concerns with this legislative vehicle because I think it runs counter to two primary principles that the ACTs are based upon. The underpinning of the formation of area commissions on transportation are the issues of consensus, of a regional perspective. I have concerns that the legislative language creates a potential here in its structure to pit rural perspectives with urban perspectives. I think that's a recipe for conflict rather than consensus, to be very honest with you. And I have a concern that this preordains an outcome, a structure, without engaging regional input into this significant conversation. Again, there is little question, and I have said many times, that the Area Commissions on Transportation, now in its 16th year, is probably the best decision the Oregon Transportation Commission has made. It has better informed the overall transportation debate in the state of Oregon. Now, I've laid concerns out here, and I wouldn't want you to think I'm just going to leave that dead cat on the table here. I want you to know we at ODOT have offered a pathway to address these concerns, and I think they're on OLIS, they're represented in the Dash 3 language here. The offer is to bring the regional partners as a whole. And I am including the good folks of Hood River County, of Clackamas County, Multnomah, Washington County, as well as those parts of Columbia County, to come to the table and have a discussion, whether you're inside or outside the MPO boundary, to vet this issue, to thoroughly vet this Area Commission on Transportation issue, and to chart a course for the formation of one or more acts. I additionally have suggested that this type of comprehensive conversation bring back its findings to the appropriate legislative committees in 2014, as well as the Oregon Transportation Commission, because again, these are commissioned, endorsed, and directed bodies that we engage in. And I believe this this type of activity will allow that all voices to be heard and help chart a potential new course for the way we engage the transportation debate up in ODOT's Region 1 area. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I stand down and would be happy to answer any questions folks may have.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, the concern obviously is these folks don't think they're being heard. Is there some data that would suggest that that's indeed the case, that they've been left out in decision-making, funding, and other things that folks that have a louder voice aren't missing?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Benz, obviously I think that would be better answered from the good folks who testified. I mean, I think they can speak with some specificity. But let me share with you one instance that I think we should have a very blunt conversation on this. It has been a conversation that has played itself out over time. This is not new. So the question is, why aren't these voices being heard? And who should listen to them? If it's not within the MPO, so the good folks that make up the 27 entities that make up the Metro's JPAC, where the transportation discussion takes place, if they're not being heard there, might they have a forum with the counties? Now, I know the Clackamas County has a four C's group. I think it's a gathering of issues, the communities of interest here. Is that forum, has that been optimized? Is the voice being heard there or is it not? I would say most recently, and here's maybe to your point specifically, Mr. Benz, we have the 2015-2018 STIP conversation, the enhanced fix-it. We've had that testimony come before this committee, a new direction where we go. We actually created a special
group up in the Region 1 area, because there is not an area commission on transportation. Most of this conversation is transpiring across the state in the ACTS. But without that forum up in Portland, we created something called a Region 1 STIP stakeholder group, for lack of... We gave the various counties, Washington, Multnomah, Clackamas, four slots. They can choose whomever they want to populate those slots. And unfortunately, I think the good folks who spoke that said they don't have a voice, those types of communities weren't placed on that conversation to inform the 2015-2018 census. So that may validate the concern that their voices aren't being heard. And I believe that. So let us create a forum to do just that, but let's not preordain its structure until we engage all those folks that I think will be critical to the transportation debate up in the Portland Metro, the greater Portland Metro area, and see exactly what chart they wish to chart in that direction. I think that is the way to have this conversation. Let them decide whether we create, as was referred to, this mega act, or potentially another act that encompasses a different composition of folks. But rather than imposing it from a piece of legislation, or literally imposing it from a Department of Transportation or the Commission, let that come up from the ground up and let them decide how to truly structure this conversation in these forums.
So what can you say? I can imagine a skeptic hearing your statement and saying that it sounds like a delay tactic or something like that. Can you reassure us about what your plans are absent the legislation?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the question. I can tell you it is not a delay tactic. I'd like to engage this conversation. There's always a ripeness to a discussion, whether it's with the folks who sit outside the metropolitan or the MPO boundary, or whether it is with the good folks of JPAC. I understand this conversation is playing itself out on both fronts here. It's just, to date, it's been an issue of timing. It hasn't been ripe. Maybe House Bill 2945 actually it becomes the catalyst to engage this conversation. But I can tell you from a department agency perspective and from a Transportation Commission perspective, we stand ready to engage this discussion. We just want to bring folks to the table to have it. So we aren't delaying. We want to engage the activities as we speak.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Garrett, for being here. I'm assuming the dash threes are the amendments that you put forward
for the bill? It's the language that I put on the table to answer my concerns. Against.
Dash threes, because there's two amendments.
That's correct.
So if I'm reading these correctly, the dash threes would exclude any portions of Multnomah County that are in Metro, in any portions of Washington County that are in Metro, if I read these amendments correctly, to come inform this act?
No. Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, the intent of the dash threes would bring everybody to the table, those folks inside the MPO boundaries, as well as those folks outside. I want to have a comprehensive conversation as to what the forum should look like up in that area here. Again, if you look across the state, very common to have the cluster of counties represent the makeup of the Area Commission on Transportation. It's holistic. It's regional, because again, as I said before, a regional perspective is at its underpinning of what an act is all about here. So again, with that intent, trying to bring those good folks together and have this comprehensive or holistic discussion as to what direction we may need to go with regard to the formation of an Area Commission.
Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, thank you. There apparently was an act formed some relatively near years ago of a county, and the assertion has been that if they had to do it legislatively, then that may be the only way to do it. Can you give us the history on that?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Benz, I think you're referring to the conversation that played itself out in 2010, directed at Lane County. And again, just a little bit of the history. There was significant pushback from the Board of County Commissioners in Lane County. They did not want an act. They did not like the legislative vehicle. That conversation had played itself out over time. But then again, with I think it was Senate Bill 944 in the 2010 session, movement was made to engage the conversation. I will tell you the beginnings of the conversation. There was a little whitewater, little bumpiness in terms of the over composition and the weighting of who would make up the membership. How would the how do you populate those discussions? And there was actually some back and forth with the Lane County Board and my Transportation Commission in terms of that configuration here. And again, what was brought forward the first time to the commission, my commission said that's not good enough. Again, it doesn't speak to the consensus that we're looking for as we engage these conversations. It was sent back, and I think because of the hard work of the board as well as the various jurisdictions around that, they came up with a compromise that brought forth that sense of consensus and how they move forward in the conversations in Lane counties. Now, that said, even with a difficult start, I will tell you, if you were to bring folks that represent the Lane County Area Commission on Transportation, I think they would speak in very favorable terms in terms of how it has bettered the transportation debate in Lane County. Again, Lane County as a whole, from Eugene Springfield to Vernita to Florence, all those folks now sit around the table and inform that conversation. And it's a very productive and positive conversation.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony and your questions and answers. That completes the list of people who have signed up to testify. We're going to close the we'll ask Representative Cameron 2 minutes for him and 2 minutes less for your bill.
Well, I'm here until I need to be here.
Okay. I don't know if we'll get kicked out. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Bill Kenemer, thank you, and I'll try to make this very brief. I just think a couple of other points of information. One is this bill is modeled nearly word for word off of the 2009 Senate Bill 944. Secondly, the proposal to, let's talk about rural-urban splits. Most of you are rural. I think you understand that there is a difference, and I think trying to work in an urban act that would be about 1.7 million, and that's a conservative estimate, and have these folks receive the sort of attention that their unique needs have is not realistic. And I think it moves them from being in the back of the bus to beyond the trailer, and if you'll pardon that. But it's just, I think it's very tough. I think that we've had some examples presented about STIP and other places, and it's been 12 years. If this were 2 years out, 3 years out, 5 years out, but it's been 12 years that this battle's been going on, I think it's really time to close the gate and say, you know, it's time to, it's a process, we're following the same model that's worked very successfully down there, and I appreciate very much the opportunity to add my final remarks, and I appreciate your attention and listening to all of us. I think people gave great testimony, you have the facts. We hope you'll support us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kenner. With that, we close the public hearing. Now I've lost my agenda. 29:45, and we're going to carry over the bill to our Wednesday agenda. That leaves us with one more bill to try and get to today. That's a public hearing on House Bill 2411. Representative Cameron, do you want to go around, and Troy can give us a summary, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2411 directs Department of Transportation to offer extended hours at field offices, requires departments' field offices to remain open on state-mandated furlough days, declares emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Kevin Cameron. I represent House District 19, South Salem, Rural Salem, Almsville, and Turner. And I'm looking at the clock, and I think it's appropriate that this bill is going to be heard probably into extended hours of our workday. As we all know, we put in the hours that it takes to serve our constituents, and there's been several here today waiting to share on many bills. And that's what this bill is all about, is service to our constituents in the state of Oregon. Voices need to be heard, and when those voices have been expressed and maybe the action, proper action hasn't taken place, then maybe it's time to bring some legislation forward to get some attention for our constituents. House Bill 2411 has a little bit of history to it. In January 2012, the Oregon Department of Transportation, DMV, informed the Legislative Assembly, and I was one of those people, that it would be closing Saturday services across the state. Although Saturdays are the busiest day of the week at some locations, for example, the Department of Motor Vehicles located in South Salem received approximately 11,000 customer visits during 2011 on its Saturday service, the busiest day of the week. Approximately 70% of those Saturday transactions are related to driver's licensing. Many of them youth, parents taking their kids in on Saturday to take their driver's test. People who can't get away from work without losing pay. Due to the technical specialists at the DMV headquarters not being available on Saturdays, other services were unable to be completed. This would lead the customers needing to make a second visit during the week, and as a result, creating a high level of customer unsatisfaction, including the door being torn off the South Salem DMV because people were so frustrated with the service that they were getting. In response to long lines out the door of a business, we closed it. I'm here to tell you that if any retail business did that, they'd be out of business. I'd just like to read the intro to the bill. Whereas the Department of Transportation field offices serves approximately 9,500 Oregonian residents daily, and whereas when the department closes all field offices on weekends and to accommodate furlough days, it reduces the time Oregon residents may access those services, and whereas field offices that have offered Saturday service experience a high volume of customers, and whereas the residents of Oregon are the customers of the department, and whereas the customers fund the paychecks of the department's employees, and whereas the department is systematically closing all field offices that offer Saturday hours and closing all field offices on furlough days, forcing Oregon residents, by the way, who pay that paycheck, to miss work in order to conduct business with the department, now therefore, and you can read the rest of the bill. I have several testimonies in my file here that have been sent to me in support of this bill, but I want to read one. It was sent today at 2:26 this afternoon to my office. It is a pity that the DMV has done away with Saturday service. Doing away with this service impacts most wage earners who must work during the same hours the DMV is open. Lawmakers need to look out for their constituents who cannot afford or even hope to get time off work to come into the DMV during the work week. Please advocate for the need for the DMV to change their hours so that Saturdays are once again available for operation. I recommend that they close Mondays so that they can be open on Saturdays. Also, the DMV should set aside one day a week when they start operations later so that they can remain open later. This would be another way to benefit those who work during the day. Today, I was at the DMV for well over an hour before I was seen. This was time off work I wish I could have avoided. Bob Garcia. Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Cameron. Any questions for the representative before we hear from some other folks? Thank you. Two people to testify, and then we'll hear from the department. Brad Brunhauer, hopefully I've pronounced that correctly, and Mark Shipman. And I'll apologize in advance for perhaps having to hurry you along.
No problem, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Brad Brunhaver, and I have a small business. I'm a small business owner and resident here in Marion County. I'm a novice at this.
No problem. You're just talking to us in conversations. Just fine.
I want to urge the approval of House Bill 2411. As a business owner and knowing many hardworking people here in the Salem area and throughout the state, I think this bill would provide the flexibility for many to be able to get the things done they need to at the DMV. Thank you for your time, and are there any questions?
Thank you. Let's hear from your colleague, and then we'll see about questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Vice Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Shipman. I'm a small business owner here in Salem, and I'm currently the past chair of the Salem Area Chamber of Commerce, speaking this afternoon on behalf of the Salem Chamber and our 1,200 members in support of House Bill 2411. This bill will allow for more flexibility with respect to consumers and customers of DMV to access DMV, including options as evening and weekend hours. Flexibility in this case is a good thing, and I would urge you to pass this bill and to move it on. Thank you very much.
Very concise. Thank you. Are there questions for either of these two? Let's see. Thank you very much. Thanks. We appreciate your testimony and your patience. Mr. McClellan, Ms. Joyce.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV administrator. Introduce yourself.
I'm Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation.
As you've heard, the bill before you, House Bill 2411, will require that we offer extended weekday hours to remain open during mandated furlough closure days when other state agencies are closed, and to offer Saturday service hours in half of our field offices. DMV operates 60 field offices across the state. Those offices range in size from the very small of one or two people in about 17 of our offices. And examples would be Lakeview, Coquille, Junction City, Cottage Grove, Burns, to very large, 25 FTE in our Southeast Portland office. We have a couple in the 18 to 19 range, but they're very different in size and we also offer four satellite offices that are open only one day per week, or in one case, one day per month in Condon, staffed with a rotation of employees from surrounding field offices who then travel to those locations. Over the last several years, we've seen a shift in how our customers access our services and the types of transactions that we must complete in our field offices. The simplest transactions can be conducted over the internet: vehicle registration renewals, address changes, notice that a vehicle has been sold, while other transactions can be done by mail. Title transactions, also the vehicle registration renewals, can be done by mail. Only the most complex transactions must be done in field offices, such as applying for or renewing a driver's license or an ID card, and some complex title-type transactions. In essence, we're trying to keep people out of our offices. We want them to do the services that they need with DMV through these other channels, these other opportunities that they have, and not go to the field office and leave that for the people who need to be there. Consequently, to try to keep the office hours shorter. The issuance processes for driver licenses have become more complex, more time-consuming for us, and consequently require more subject matter expertise from our help desk and from our technical staff in our headquarters building than we did several years ago. We began adjusting field offices several years ago to achieve the best customer service possible for Oregonians due to the reduced need for field offices and the increasing complexity of those transactions. We closed the last four limited service offices. At one point they were called express offices. We had four that we closed in the last 2 years: Valley River, Tannisborn, Lloyd Center, and Clackamas Town Center. Those were limited in the types of services that they could do. No drive tests, no VIN inspections, those types of things. And we were seeing a decline in the number of people going to those offices, primarily because the simple transactions are now done over the internet or through the mail in other ways. So we felt a need to close those and consolidate the staff from those offices in nearby full-service offices. We just moved the staff to cover the additional workload that would be needed from that. Benefits derived from the Monday through Friday service: greater consistency across the state. Just because an office is just down the street doesn't mean that people don't go 5, 10, 15, 20 miles to a different office. And what we find is they come to expect certain services and certain hours of the day from what DMV is going to offer to them. So we really have strived to be more consistent in what we offer across the state. More transactions being completed in a single visit. It was just mentioned that some transactions could not be finished on a Saturday because of that technical support from the field offices, from the headquarters for the field offices. Maybe drive tests wouldn't be offered on Saturdays as well, which we could do during the week on a Monday through Friday schedule. We have increased the number of drive test appointments in those offices as a result of moving to Monday through Friday. Our wait times are lower and more consistent through the week, where we sometimes saw, occasionally some of the offices, like South Salem is a good example, we'd see a lot of people in a short period of time, and the wait time would be very high, long wait times, which isn't good service for us. What we want to do is provide more consistent services and spread those volumes across the week as best we can so they don't have to wait as long and get bad service from DMV. We believe there's a positive public perception from being more efficient in the resources that we are given to provide services. We very rarely get additional positions in order to do the work that we're required to do. We've also seen some savings in overtime, shift differential, and travel because of this more consistent Monday through Friday schedule. We are in a downsizing mode in our agency right now. We've eliminated 17.5 FTE in the last 2 years. We're expected to give up another 24 or 25 positions over the next 2 years. It doesn't mean our workload is declining. If anything, it's going up. So it's incumbent upon us to be more efficient, more creative in the way we do serve the public. And I think I've said this already, but customer service is part of our ethos, is part of our culture at DMV, serving the public as best we can with the resources that we are given. We did do a pilot November 2010 through August of 2011, about a 9-month period, which coincided with the closure of a couple of offices and changes in the Portland area. Our North, Northeast, Gladstone, Gresham, and Southeast Portland offices tried out extended hours from 8 o'clock until 6 o'clock p.m., a 10-hour period, and tracked the number of people served during those different times of the day. And you would think, if you build it, they will come. If you extend your hours past 5 o'clock, more people will come. What we found, and we measured that, is that only 2-3% of the total people served during that 10-hour period were actually being served from 5 to 6 p.m. And some of them would have been served anyway because they came before 5 o'clock. And even though we might close the door to new people at 5 o'clock, we serve everybody in the waiting room until we're done. That might be 5:30, 5:45, even 6 o'clock sometimes before we're actually able to turn the lights out and say we're done. So some of those people were counted in the ones that we, during that period. So it was only, you would expect, if it was even 10% over the course of a 10-hour day, we were only getting 2 or 3%. Just it wasn't generating the workload that you might have thought from the working adults, students, those others that might have taken advantage of it. We recognize that customer service has many components, and only one of those is the hours that you're open. We do a monthly customer satisfaction survey. We randomly sample 400 people who go to our field offices every month, and Oregon State helps us with that survey. They give us feedback. How are we doing? And we get very high marks. But the types of things we measure are employee helpfulness, courtesy, our knowledge, our professionalism. What did you think of the wait time? Those are the types of things we're measuring. We also receive comments from people as they're scoring us on these different areas, and very rarely do we have any comment that's related to hours of service. I looked at our January customer satisfaction surveys. We had 40 comments. Only one had to do with office hours. In Cave Junction. We've never actually offered Saturday service in Cave Junction, but that was the only one out of all the different comments had anything to do with the hours that we are open. We respond very promptly to questions and comments that we get, either through the survey process or the customer comments in our field offices. Our agency also has a citizen representative office that we respond within 5 days to any concerns or complaints that people might have. I could read you some of the comments that we get. Typically, and this has been over many years, our satisfaction rates where people give us a good or an excellent rating is in an 83 to 87% range. It hardly ever varies from year to year, month to month. People are very satisfied with the work we give, especially the people from California. But what we find is they're used to a 3 and a 4 hour wait. So if they can be served in 10, 15, or even 20 minutes, they're very, very pleased with the service we provide. Our job is very difficult, and I'm not asking for your sympathy at all when I say that. But we have to make some tough choices sometimes as far as when we're open to the public. And we're trying to do the best we can to provide the best service with the resources we have. And as I said, we're not getting more staff. We're not getting more money to spend. When we spread it over multiple days or longer hours, we don't generate more income, whereas a restaurant or other businesses might. It's basically the same amount of money that's going to be brought in, only a longer period of time and more costly to collect it. So with that, I'll quit. See if you have any questions.
Thank you, sir. Questions? Representative Nathanson and Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your closing remarks, you mentioned options of either multiple days, I mean more days, or longer hours. But something that interests me is the analysis of but which hours are the right hours. Mm-hmm. When I see anything from a public library to a commercial for-profit retail store adopt different hours, like on some days instead of 8 to 5, it might be 10 to 7. Mm-hmm. Or instead of Monday through Friday, maybe it's Tuesday through Saturday. So have you done any analysis of, from real-world experience you've had in different offices over, if, even if you were to retain a traditional 9-hour day and 5 days, which days and which hours would be the best?
And may I amend to that question or add to it by asking whether there's a factor about consistency, knowing that on Tuesdays it's not 8, it's 10, or if that's a problem or an advantage.
Like me trying to figure out when my branch library is open.
Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson, if you go to our website, we actually provide this advice to people. When is the best time to go? When's the worst time to go? The best time to go is in the middle of the week, Wednesday or Thursday, the middle of the month, second or third week. Try to avoid the first and last weeks of the month. Noontime, 11 to 1, is typically a fairly busy time, and we need to give our employees some lunch, so they're staggering their lunches. So sometimes we're a little short-handed when the volumes are coming in. That can be a longer wait time. 2 to 5 p.m. is a fairly busy time for us. So with that information in hand, if you can schedule your time around that, we are pretty busy usually 8 to 10 o'clock. But mid-morning, it tends to drop off. But with any queue that ends up being built, it's hard to get it broken down. Once you start to get behind and the wait time starts to grow, it takes a lot to intervene to bring it back down to where you want it to be, especially in our larger offices.
This is bringing back memories of the operations class in business school and queuing theory.
It's very relevant.
It's good to hear that. Representative Parrish?
Thanks. I want to go back to something you said early on about looking to have to do reduction in force of, 17, 20 people or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you also said that your work is going up. So you're fee-based, right? I mean, I come in and pay however much for a driver's license. You're fee-based. Your work's going up, but you're cutting people. Where's the cost overrun in the operations of the DMV?
Chair Reed, Representative Parrish, when I say we're making staffing cuts, it's because we're part of an agency that's bigger than DMV. The Department of Transportation, as we forecast out revenues, gas tax, our fees, other sources of income, federal money, the concern is that there's a cliff, basically, that we are faced with as an agency. And as part of that agency, I have a responsibility to come up with savings in the DMV to make a greater contribution to the State Highway Fund through the cuts that I'm making. And unlike a private business, when I bring in more money, it doesn't mean I can hire more people. I'm set by the limits that this body sets in the number of positions that I can have and can fill at any one time. There are two aspects to that answer, I think.
So do you have any kind of analysis on whether DMV is self-sustaining outside of the ODOT piece? Because you are fee-based, and I guess it's a little disconcerting to me as a consumer that, you know, if the money's being siphoned off to ODOT, no offense ODOT, but if the money's being siphoned off to ODOT and it's causing a backlog in time and inconvenience for customers, that's problematic for me as someone who also has a customer service background. So do you have any data that you could, would DMV break even by yourself if you were spun off?
Representative Perez, I feel compelled to break in and suggest that there's also a customer service experience about driving on the roads that we're paying to be licensed on, too. So they do connect, but happy to have you coming.
Chair Reed, Representative Perez, one of the core elements of our mission as a part of a state agency is the collection of revenues for the state's transportation system. And anything we don't need for the administration of our programs and services that we provide does go to cities and counties in the state highway fund, with a few exceptions like driver ed money and things like that. But that is part of our charge as an organization, is to raise money for the state's transportation system. We're nearing the completion of a comprehensive fee study. It's been many years since our costs have really been analyzed. The fee increases that we've actually had over the last 10 to 12 years have been for the transportation system, for the Jobs and Transportation Act, for the OTIA 1 and 3 bonds that were issued, for bridge repairs and things like that. Predominantly, the fee increases have been for those purposes, not to recover our costs. That's why we are doing the study, and that will be brought back to the legislature at some point when we're finished this summer.
I guess I would just argue, if you're the revenue-generating arm, or a revenue-generating arm, and you're trying to make money, cutting back staff in a piece of our government that is a money-maker makes no sense to me whatsoever. But
Representative Parrish, we had a very similar discussion in the Revenue Department about the allocations that impact the Department of Revenue. Appreciate your comment. Other questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much. We appreciate the testimony, appreciate the discussion, and that completes the list of people who have signed up to testify on House Bill 2411. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2411. And just before we adjourn, I want to make sure that we've done all the correct things here. We're going to carry over House Bill 2277, we're going to carry over House Bill 3137, carry over Senate Bill 612, and carry over House Bill 3443. I also announced earlier that we're going to carry over House Bill 2945 and House Bill 2657. What have we got, Troy?
I believe so.
Okay, so committee, please be prepared for a busy Wednesday. We'll be moving quickly through a number of these and hopefully completing our agenda around the right time on Wednesday. Is there anything else to come before the committee today? See me.
Mr. Chair. Thank you for the hearing.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
No problem. You ready to drop the gavel? I'm going to make absolutely sure in these last couple of minutes that I don't inadvertently drop the gavel
matters a lot
yes,
right now.
It does matter a lot.
We've covered them all.
Okay, we've covered them all. We're adjourned. Thank you.